Good morning and welcome to MTSU on the Record. I'm Jenna Logue, and we're coming to you from the campus of Middle Tennessee State University in Murfreesboro, Tennessee, in the studios of WMOT-FM. Our 2009 Tennessee Undergraduate Social Science Symposium gets underway November 10th and 11th here on the campus. And one of the featured speakers is Dr. Paula England, who is a sociology professor at Stanford University, and she's also an affiliate at the Clayman Institute for Gender Research. The topic of Dr. England's address is going to be gender equality, what's changing, what's not. Dr. England, thank you for taking the time to join us today on MTSU on the Record.
You're welcome.
Well, if when you say what's changing, what's not, are you talking about the labor force, personal relationships, society in general, all of the above?
Well, kind of all of the above. You know, one of the things that's changed the most is what percent of women are employed outside the home. If we look at a period from, say, 1950 to the present, there's just been this huge increase in women's employment. So that's an example of something that's changed a lot. The sex gap in pay has gotten smaller. We still aren't at equality, but it's gotten smaller. Women have moved into a lot of formerly mostly male professions and occupations. So those things have actually changed quite a bit over the decades.
Some people say that because we are in a down economy right now, to the extent that anyone is getting hired at all, more women are getting hired because the pay gap does still exist and women get paid less, saving the employers money. Is there anything to that?
You know, I don't think it's true that if you take a man and a woman that are not employed and on the market, the woman has the advantage. It is true that women are often paid less, but oftentimes where the pay gap is coming from is that women tend to cluster in female-dominated jobs and men tend to cluster in male-dominated jobs, and employers pay the male jobs more, sometimes even when they don't require more education. And we can think of that as a type of discrimination. I used to write on that. We called it comparable worth, the idea that, you know, similarly skilled male and female occupations, even if they involve different tasks, shouldn't pay differently just because one's done by women and men. But generally, so the pay differences are not so big within occupations, and so I don't think it favors the women candidates that much. Now, there has been a lot of stuff in the newspapers about more men have lost their jobs in the recession, and that is correct. And that is really because the type of jobs that employers tend to do layoffs in are like blue-collar jobs, for example. They're more likely to lay off the blue-collar factory workers when their profits are way down than to lay off their own secretaries, for example. But so therefore, like the clerical workers keep their jobs more. So to the extent that the recession has disfavored men, it's not because employers won't hire them. It's because more of them are getting laid off because they're in the types of jobs that are more sensitive to these business cycles.
So the clerical workers are still underpaid, but at least they get to keep their jobs because the boss absolutely cannot do without a right-hand executive aide or personal assistant.
Right, or at least doesn't want to.
Right. when you say that more men are losing their jobs, or rather that the women cluster to jobs that have been traditionally women's and men cluster to jobs that have been traditionally men, do we do that because of some sort of social indoctrination, or because it's what our parents' generation did, or because we don't want to step outside of our comfort zone, or is it because of some kind of employer or workforce-imposed discrimination?
Well, I think it's all of the above, and it's a really tough thing to study. A lot of sociologists and economists have studied it, but, you know, it's really hard to get data from companies. They don't want to give it out on, like, who applied for these jobs and what were their qualifications and then who did they choose. And I believe that there is some discrimination in hiring still against women in male-dominant jobs and actually against men in female-dominant jobs. I think that amount of hiring discrimination has declined over time, and part of it is socialization, whether you call it social indoctrination or what our parents did. I mean, all those are the same kind of social forces that we just kind of don't question what's an appropriate thing to do. Now, there has been substantial change in that, particularly from women's side. Women, you know, for example, are now half of med schools, about half of law schools. They're, I think, half of veterinary schools, all these fields that there may be 30 or 40% of MBA programs. So all the fields that have been traditionally male, women have moved into in big numbers. By contrast, men have not moved into fields that were traditionally female so much. Also, it looks like this kind of desegregation of women going into both fields of study and then also applying for jobs that were traditionally male, it looks like the big change in that was kind of in the 70s and 80s, and there hasn't been so much change, say, in the last 15 years in the kind of desegregation of jobs. So it seems like in some ways the gender revolution is stalled, both with respect to women's employment, which went up and up and up and then kind of flattened off, and with respect to desegregation of jobs, where women made lots of changes, and then recently it's kind of leveled off.
Well,
by recently, I mean the last 10 years or so.
Right. Well, it seems that the student body populations of colleges and universities are becoming overwhelmingly female these days over male, and there are several reasons people posit for this, possibly that women mature quicker than men and adapt better to the self-discipline and time management qualities necessary to succeed in a college career. But once those women graduate and go out into the labor force, what are we going to see? What kind of impact is that going to be? Are we going to have a bunch of overqualified, underemployed women with college degrees who can't get into the good-paying jobs they want?
Well, possibly. I think the whole question of as you say, women are now more than half of people graduating from college, of college students and people graduating from college, and that is a historic reversal. Actually, women attained about equality in college graduation rates somewhere in time in the 80s, so it's been true for a while, but now they're actually exceeding men. But if you go back to the 50s and 60s and before that, men got college degrees much more than women. And I think the reasons that people give, the odd thing about these reasons as explanations is that they've long been true. I mean, for example, girls get slightly higher grades in high school. But that was true all the way back to 1950. But in 1950, it wasn't creating more girls going to college. Girls follow directions and sit still a little better. This is on average, right? Some boys are doing just fine. But that was true in 1950, too. So I think what really changed is that back then, even though the girls were better students, the idea that men but not women will have jobs and careers was so strong that it was felt that only men need a college education, and that if families could only afford to send one, of course they would send the son. And it was kind of an upper-class luxury to educate daughters. And that's changed, and people assume that, well, women will have jobs too. And then now that there's kind of more equal playing field on do people think men and women need to go to college, these differences that have always been there of the women kind of stick with it and do well slightly more seem to be creating a gap in graduation rates and things. But as you say, that's not necessarily reflecting that's not going to be enough to, you know, get rid of all the inequality in the labor market, partly because there's lots of people that don't go to college, men and women. But it probably will create a situation where it probably will create a situation where a lot more men are kind of stuck in service jobs and kind of can't get into jobs that require education. But what women are often in is jobs that require education but are really badly paid for the amount of education they require. And nothing seems to be changing that too much.
The curriculum, however, that it prepares women for the workforce, or at least purports to, has changed, though, since the 1950s. And in the 50s, women were taking home economics. Well, hardly anybody teaches home economics. They might teach a more diverse, you know, lifestyle preparation for marriage or something like that course, but it's not the June Cleaver home economics course that our mothers might have taken.
Right. And, for example, if you go back into, the 60s or even 1970, something like a third of all women getting bachelor's degrees were getting it in education to become teachers, and that number has really plummeted because women have gone into other majors, you know, business and accounting and, some of the traditionally male majors as well. So, business and accounting were traditionally male majors, and some of the other ones, like the sciences. The women are still underrepresented in the hard sciences, but not so much now in the kind of business accounting type fields.
I'm glad you brought that up, because we have a chemistry professor on campus who has an annual event aimed at middle school age girls designed to help keep them from losing their elementary school interest in math and science and related fields when they turn the corner into puberty, because statistics seem to indicate that they do so. And she says, well, there are a myriad of reasons for this lack or loss of interest. One of them is that science teachers in classes don't tend to treat little girls who raise their hands with the same degree of gravitas that they treat little boys who raise their hands.
Yeah, I've seen some research to that effect. I'm not really an expert in that area, but it is an interesting thing to look at, of what's really going on in those classrooms that discourages the girls, because we know that, they're doing just as well in it up to the point where they lose interest. However, I have also read that now in high school, and maybe this isn't true in Tennessee, I don't know, but at a national level in high school, the gender gap in taking almost all science and math classes in high school has completely closed. The only exception is physics. So even, the high-level math, pre-calc, AP math, there's just as high a proportion of the girls as the boys taking it. And so what I've been reading is that now the issue is more, well, what major do they choose, when they start getting in? And there you see a lot more, many fewer of the girls choosing, say, engineering and things. So that, but it still seems like the program your chemistry professor is doing is a really good one, because you want to keep women interested, And some of the problem is the lack of interest, even when they're doing well in it, and in fact taking the pipeline courses in high school.
That's really interesting. I don't know what the numbers are for Tennessee, but I think it would be interesting to look that up and compare them. Let's talk for a little bit now about you mentioned comparable worth. It used to be an evergreen or perennial story for the news media to throw up on Mother's Day to calculate what it would cost for you to hire someone to do everything mom does at home for free.
Right.
And it seems that mom is still doing it at home for free, whether she has a job outside the home or whether she has a job inside the home or both, without necessarily as much cooperation from dad and the kids as she would like.
Right.
Do we see this trend changing at all?
There has been some change. Now, as women go and get paid jobs, they do a lot less housework, but they still do a disproportionate share of what's done. Now, there has been some increase in men's housework in the U.S. and other countries, and some increase in men's time with their kids in kind of parenting activities. But women are still doing the lion's share of it, even when they're working. And so this is sort of one of the examples of, you know, I titled the talk I'm going to give, What's Changing and What's Not. And, you know, what has changed is a lot of things about women's employment and what fields women are choosing. But what hasn't changed as much is men taking on more of the traditionally female responsibilities. And that's true whether we're talking about in the workplace, you know, becoming a nurse or waitress or something like that. But it's also true at home. And, of course, this then impacts how much women's careers can change, because there's sort of limits to how much you can put into a career if you're the one doing 75% of the household and child-rearing work. So it seems like people have had more of an idea that it's okay for women to change and less of an idea that it's okay or required or the responsibility of men to change. And I think, therefore, the gender revolution hasn't really been much of a two-way street, you know.
With regard to this, the woman can not only quite possibly become physically stressed out by the double duty, but some women might very easily see the lack of cooperation from the husband or the domestic partner as a lack of respect or even a lack of love. What kind of an emotional toll does this take on the domestic relationship?
Well, you know, there is one study I remember seeing that showed that when women thought the allocation of housework was more fair, they were less likely to be thinking of divorce. So obviously sometimes it does, you know, really affect the quality of, you know, her perception of the overall quality of the relationship.
There was a topic that you mentioned off air that you're doing research on right now, that you wanted to bring into the discussion, and it has to do with college age dating attitudes, men for women and women for men, and how they are changing or not. Tell me what you're finding.
Well, I started this, you know, I'm in my late 50s, so I'm feeling very old these days relative to college students. And when I was teaching at another university, a student came to my office one day and said, well, I want to do a paper on why, I was teaching at Northwestern at the time, why Northwestern students don't date. And I said, they don't? And so I went to my class that afternoon and I said, a student came to my office today and said, students don't date much anymore. Is that true? And, well, they kind of said, yeah, not too much, you know. And then one guy raised his hand and said, have you heard of a hookup? And I said, no, what's that? Of course, my street credibility fell to negative numbers then. Mm-hmm. And so what I hear from students is that, and it got me interested in starting to study this, is that, well, people don't date so much in casual dates. They hook up. And so what students mean these days by a hookup is they didn't have a prearranged date. Maybe they were hanging out in the dorm. Maybe they went to a party and ran into somebody. They probably know the person. Maybe they started dancing or something. And something physical, something sexual happened. Not always and not typically sexual intercourse, actually, but something sexual. And they call that a hookup. And it doesn't necessarily imply any interest in a relationship with a person, a boyfriend-girlfriend relationship, but it doesn't preclude that either. So I thought, well, this is really interesting, and I want to study this. So I've got an online survey going at a number of different colleges and universities, and then I do focus groups with my students, and sometimes when I go give talks at other universities, I may talk to the students about it. And it's clear that part of what's changed is that students, and I'm talking here about heterosexual students. I'm also in my study interested in LGBT students, and going to do some sort of separate on them. But if we're talking about the male-female stuff, students see themselves as, most of them want to get married someday. They see themselves as marrying pretty late relative to what it used to be. It used to be people that went to college tended to get married right out of college, you know, when you're 21 or something. These kids see themselves as getting married maybe when they're 27, 28, 29, 30, 31. So, and they often, a lot of them become sexually active, you know, say sometime between 17 and 19 maybe. So they got 10 years there. So they don't see college as the time that they're going to find their spouse. So then there's the question of, well, what are you going to do? You can have a series of relationships, boyfriend-girlfriend relationships, and sometimes they kind of it kind of pushes them to this kind of more casual hookup thing, although hookups can also be kind of the pathway into relationships. So in a way, it's kind of like putting something sexual first. You know, the old formula was more you do dates and then you get to know each other, and then if there's sort of a steady progression and an interest in a relationship, then maybe that's accompanied by increased sexual contact. And so in a way, that's kind of been turned around. So, you know, that's kind of what I see going on. And one of the things I've been interested in is, well, is this like a feminist victory for women, or is this just like an intensification of exploitation of women? And, you know, people really disagree on that, including the students themselves. And I think maybe there's some of each.
Is any of this either initiated by or facilitated by social networking, Facebook, Twitter, etc.?
Well, social networking certainly gets involved in it because the kids are so into it. But I actually think the bigger thing that kind of facilitates it is, first of all, you're at college and you're away from your parents. But then, of course, that's always been true of college. And then now you've got co-ed dorms. So there's a kind of ease. Now, co-ed dorms also form lots of cross-sex groups of friends that, you know, are platonic but just are friends in a way that was never true when I was a college student. I think that's maybe a victory of the gender revolution, that men and women think they have enough in common that they might just want to be friends, you know. But I think it's also facilitates easy sort of sexual access because people are out of the watchful eye of their parents and in a situation where there's lots of other people of their age, all most of whom are single, and then they're in these dorms where sometimes there's this mixing even more readily than, you know, would otherwise be the case.
Do hookups alleviate the feeling of societal expectations? For example, if you make a date, make an appointment, could be ready on time, this, that, there are, you know, unwritten rules, or at least society has unwritten rules for what you can do and what you can't do, so forth. And the way you describe a hookup, it's free. You can have sex. You can not have sex. You get to know people. You can associate with them once and then several times thereafter, or not ever see them again. It sounds more liberating,
right,
for one and all.
Sense, it's, yes, and it's, in that sense, I think that's part of what kids like about it. It's very flexible, and it's kind of free. And I think also what the guys like about it, since traditionally guys ask women on dates, is they don't have to risk being – they don't have to go through all that embarrassing stuff of asking someone. Now, what I thought would happen is that women would start asking men on dates too. But rather than that changing, the date just became less common. But – that also creates lots of ambiguities. Like a lot of times you don't know if someone's really interested in a relationship with you or not, right?
Yeah, and I would think also that with this additional freedom comes the necessity for a certain amount of savvy on the part of the girl, because although you might be introduced to other people in this hookup by mutual friends, if for some reason two people decide to go off together, she might have some degree of expectations and he might have other expectations, and she might find herself with someone who would impose something on her she doesn't necessarily want. I wonder where date rape falls into this.
Absolutely. And, you know, I sort of realized when I started understanding this whole party leading to hookup thing that, you know, I was teaching in my gender classes about date rape, and I realized, well, the rape may still be there, but not the dates, that what one sociologist who's written on this calls party rape, that this does happen sometimes, that, you know, the girl, and by the way, these are almost always accompanied by lots of alcohol, so they're at a frat party or something, and They're dancing and having a good time, and they're drinking, and he suggests they go up to his room to talk or whatever, and they go up there, and something gets negotiated or not, and sometimes, you know, she ends up having sex that she didn't want to have, and sometimes there's, you know, even some physical force involved, and this does happen. I mean, it's not happening in the typical hookup, but it definitely does happen, and it's not the... so much, you know, you get in the car with Jack the Ripper and go somewhere, because these things are tending to happen on campus, and usually there are people that know the person and that sort of thing, but these things do happen. And I'll tell you, one of the most distressing things to me about the whole scene has been that I thought, well, okay, if there's this kind of free, liberalized thing, I mean, some people might think it's bad, some people might think it's better, but at least it would be kind of equal between men and women. But what I see is that there's still really a double standard, so that women can still get judged for engaging in casual sex in a way that's much more than men get judged for it. So it's not sort of equal opportunity judgments. And because of that, coming back to your questions about rape, if the woman feels that it was forced on her, she may be reluctant to tell anyone because she doesn't want all these people knowing that she went up to his room and hooked up with him. Now, some women will brag about it, but the guy isn't under that same problem that if he reveals this, he'll be judged harshly. And women do say that if they hook up with too many people, they get called sluts. You know, sometimes guys are called man whores. But
so when men get to have both sides of the situation, they get to have fun without ruining their reputation, and perhaps in some cases maybe even enhancing it. Whereas the woman still risks losing her reputation, even if she enjoys her sexual freedom numerous times.
Right. Yeah, that's exactly it. So what I have been really surprised to learn, I should probably put this in the lecture that I'm giving about one of the things that hasn't changed, is how much the double standard of judging women more harshly for having sex outside of a serious relationship persists. And I sort of thought it would have gone away. In fact, I thought it had sort of gone away in the 80s, but apparently I was just traveling in rarefied circles or something. I don't know. And so in that sense, there's still a pretty big mix of gender inequality in this kind of personal sphere. So I think in some ways it's better than the old system. In some ways it's worse. It's sort of, there's kind of some of each.
We don't have very much time left, but... If I may digress from the central topic a bit, just to focus on something contemporary, I'd like to get your take on the David Letterman situation, because the National Organization for Women has come out and condemned what he has done. He seems to be able to joke his way out of it, and nothing has come to light to indicate that the relationships were coercive in any way that he had with women on his staff. However, there does seem to be a double standard in that the conventional male employer who is not a popular celebrity would not have been able to get away with this so easily.
Yeah. You know, this is a really interesting area, because it's an area where the norms have really shifted. For example, in academia, it's now seen as sexual harassment, kind of by definition, for a faculty member, a male or female, to have sexual relations with anyone, or any romantic or dating relations at all with anyone, male or female, that they are grading or in a class with or in any supervisory situation with. So universities, and by the way, it used to be completely common for graduate students to have affairs with their professors, and nobody thought there was, and you know, it was usually the student was a female and the professor was a male, and almost nobody thought anything of it. Well, some people thought it was wrong, but there was no official policy. And then universities have come around and made these really strict policies about it. And the idea is that the power differential between the person with authority and the person without makes it a situation where it really can't be an equal, that you can't be sure there was really consent there. And I think that's kind of the concern with something like this. You know, on the other hand, people sometimes think, well, at some point you're an adult and you should be able to make your own choices. So, you know, there's probably nothing legal. Well, it depends on what, you know, facts you don't know behind the scenes of was there really any the legal status of sexual harassment tends to be, did the person make it clear that the conduct was unwelcome and then it persisted? Or is it conduct such that, you know, we can infer that any reasonable person in this situation would have thought it was harassing? So, you know, these are sticky issues.
And in this particular case, that all of that is dependent upon details that have yet to be revealed to the general public.
Right.
Dr. Paula England has been our guest today. She will be speaking at the 2009 Tennessee Undergraduate Social Science Symposium here at MTSU. The symposium is November 10th and 11th. Dr. England will be speaking on the 11th from 11:30 to 12:25, and the topic is gender equality, what's changing, what's not. Dr. England joined us today from her office at Stanford University in Stanford, California. Thank you, Dr. England, for being with us today.
Thanks so much for having me.
This is MTSU on the Record. I'm Jenna Logue. Join us again at the same time next Sunday. Don't forget to check out the podcast at your leisure at mtsunews.com. And we're also available on iTunes.